Well, we're underway. Fred had asked me to explain about counting Pentecost. And this is an interesting incident that I had when I was attending the University of Judaism way back when. In fact, it was 1974. And I was talking to Rabbi Israel Shirut. He was giving a lecture, a series of lectures. And one of them was in counting Pentecost. And he was really a character, so to speak. He had a lot of sense of humor. And he said, he went to Leviticus, talked about the morrow after the Sabbath. Shabbat, he says. What does that mean? Every place, he said, where the term HaShabbat is used, it means the weekly Sabbath. But here we say it doesn't mean it. Well, of course it means the weekly Sabbath. It doesn't mean the first day of the week. And of course, we're all taken aback, because in Judaism, you translate that as the first holy day. So therefore, Pentecost always comes out on the 6th of Sivan, a single day of the year. Now, why is that? You go back in the history, and you find out very clearly why that is so. See, you had the Pharisees versus the Sadducees. The Sadducees controlled the temple. And if you had it done on a particular day of the week, you all went to the priests. But if you made it an annual day, then it was a national holiday on an annual day, and the Pharisees dominated there. So how do you wrest control away from the Sadducees? It was simple. You translate that the first holy day. So you start counting the morrow after the 15th, which would be the 16th. Start counting that way, and you're always going to wind up on the 6th of Sivan. So the Pharisees would say, come to us, and we will explain the meaning of the day. You don't need the priests. And this is one of the main reasons why they translated it that way. And they've been doing it ever since. But it's amazing. There are still some rabbis who understand that the term HaShabbat, not your Shabbat, you'll find many times, such as in Leviticus, where it talks about the Day of Atonement. This is how you shall count your Shabbat. The term Shabbat can mean a holy day, but when you have the definite article, HaShabbat, it's always the weekly Sabbath, no exceptions. And Rabbi Shirut was simply being honest, period. He says that's what it means. But of course, we don't interpret it that way. So that's the story there. Secondly, Fred talked about translating this Old Testament. I want to emphasize something. There's no such thing as a perfect English translation of the Hebrew. Impossible. So even though we've done the best we could with this, you can't get it right 100%. Time and time again, I would read what the great rabbi said, different ones down through the ages. And you know what their comments would be? Hebrew obscure. Hebrew obscure. Not clear. Opaque. And then they would say, well, it seems to mean this. Well, if the most brilliant of Hebrew scholars don't even understand the Hebrew, how are we supposed to understand it? Okay? So when all is said and done, what I want to emphasize is this. When all is said and done, and even what we're going to discuss today, all you need to know for salvation is Jesus Christ and Him crucified. If you know that, it's enough. Now, obviously, if you know more, it's better. You get to understand the mind of God more. But when all is said and done, Jesus Christ and Him crucified, that's enough for salvation. But we're going to try to learn more. But I wanted to emphasize that in terms of this Old Testament, because you can see Hebrew words with several different meanings. Now, how do you know what meaning God is putting primarily on this word? You don't. It could have three or four different meanings, and God means all three of them. But what's he emphasizing? We're not sure. And in fact, Hebrew was meant to be read. And we don't do that. You read this in the English, and you read it aloud in the English, and you can't get it as you would in the Hebrew. And I'm sure the same thing is true in Greek. I don't know Greek as well. As I tell Fred, Greek is Greek to me. You know, going back to William Shakespeare and Julius Caesar. So I don't know Greek. Oh, yes, I can think of a few words. Theos, I can recognize Theos. I really can, but that's about it. But Hebrew is different, and the alliteration is in the Hebrew, and the pentameter is in Hebrew. It's like this. My favorite poem, and you may have different ones, but my favorite poem is Sennacherib by Lord Byron. And the melodic note, the Assyrian came down like a wolf on a fold, his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Now you try translating that into Russian or German and see what you get. Trust me, it does not work, okay? Well, Hebrew is the same way. It was all meant to be read, and the Levites, when they were going on the steps, singing the Hallel in the temple, they would be singing those songs. And the words, the phraseology, the alliteration, the pentameter, the meter, it all had meaning. We don't have that today. So we do the best we can with what we've got. Okay, with that, let's begin our topic. And we're going to be in a classroom this morning. I'll do my best. It's going to be starting out again, but a little different, what I began back in Southern California. We're covering the economy in ancient Israel, along with part of the criminal justice system. And you'll see something very fascinating about the part of the criminal justice system that we're going to talk about. And I'm going to be able to do this for the next 3 days, with about a half hour to 40 minutes each day, no more than that. And believe me, we could be here for the next week for an hour a day and not even cover the whole subject. It is that vast. To start with, we've got to realize we're dealing with law. And in the Old Testament, there are three broad categories of law. First, the moral law. This we call the Ten Commandments of God. Yes, we know technically they're not the Ten Commandments. They're the Ten Words, the Ten Sayings, the Ten Principles. But they're given in the form of commandments. So there's nothing wrong with calling them the Ten Commandments of God. These are applicable to every human being at all times. No exceptions. Now, at the other extreme, the laws of purity, of ritual. You want to read a lot of those? Read the book of Leviticus. You will get your fill of ritual and uncleanness and trespass offerings, guilt offerings, all kinds of offerings. These are not enforced today. No Levitical priesthood. Aaron's not around. The temple's not there. Now, in the world tomorrow, some of those laws will be brought back, but not today. Now, in the middle were the national statutes, and that's what we're going to deal with. And the national statutes, as they were given to the people of Israel, to be observed in the land. And I want to emphasize that. So turn with me, if you will, and we'll just read one verse, Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 1. These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to do in the land which the Lord God of your fathers gives you to possess it all the days that you live upon the earth. So here come the statutes to be observed by Israel in the land. Now we're going to back off and we're going to cover two principles that will help us understand what we're about to read. And one of those principles was taught to me when I first set foot on the Ambassador College campus by one of the, how shall I put this, kindest, caring, dedicated servant of God I ever had the privilege of meeting. He was intelligent, he was smart, he got his own doctorate degree, and Fred knows him very well. His name was Charles V. Dorothy, a remarkable man, a sweet man, if I could use that word to describe him. Humble, he never put on airs, he never thought of himself as being better than anybody else, and he taught me a fundamental lesson. He said, Mike, the Bible is a book of addition, not subtraction, addition, meaning you've got to add. You see a scripture, you read it, it's truth, but that may not be all the truth on that subject. So you got to read all the scriptures, add them together, such as we're told in Isaiah, the 28th chapter, verse 13. We don't need to turn there. You know, precept upon precept, line upon line, here, there, a little there. Okay, here a little, there a little. So you got to add to it. And the second thing is the Bible, the Old Testament, is a book of law and is written as a law book. Now understand what that means. In my business, I deal with the Internal Revenue Code. I'm a tax preparer, a tax consultant. Yeesh. You can take the Internal Revenue Code and you can honestly handle it in one hand. It's not as big as you might think. But then you have the vast array of regulations. And then you have the Internal Revenue Service writing their revenue rulings, applying it specifically to certain cases. And if you want to change from one way to another, we have what you call revenue procedures, rev procs, those of us in the business call them. But the question is, the problem is, when you read, how do you know whether you're reading something from the code, whether you know whether you're reading something from the regulations or revenue ruling? Because you see, the code is broad. It doesn't give you exceptions. It doesn't give you full explanation. It just gives you the broad principle. Well, some of what we're going to read gives you broad principle. Then you're going to read another section, and you're going to say, wait a minute, that's not what the other one says. It is. It's just expanding upon it. It's giving you the exceptions, or it's giving you the additions. Example, in the Internal Revenue Code, all income is subject to tax. All income. That's the code. But wait a minute. Not true. Except for, here we go, the exceptions. Well, you give your child an allowance. Oh, not taxable. Uncle Max dies and leaves you $1 million. Well, inheritance, not taxable. But the code says all income is taxable. Well, that's the general rule. Then come the exceptions. So now we're going to start in with the economic system in ancient Israel, and we'll start with the tithe, we'll see the general statements, and then we'll see some exceptions to it that you might think, wait a minute, we have to understand the mind of God to figure that out. So let's start in Leviticus. If ever there was a book of rules and regulations and ablutions and oblations, if you want to use that term, it is the book of Leviticus. But there are also some very, very important rules here. Good explanations. Leviticus chapter 27 and verse 30. Leviticus 27 and verse 30. And all the tithe of the land, of the seed of the land, or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. And if a man will at all redeem anything of his tithe, he shall add to it the fifth part. And all the tithe of the herd, or of the flock, all that passes under the rod, a tenth, shall be holy. He shall not search whether it is good or bad, neither shall he change it. And if he changes it at all, then both it and the change of it shall be holy. Now, we're going to see something else. When we get to the firstborn, God says something completely different. On the firstborn, there will be exceptions. We will see a rule that says all the firstborn is mine. But then God also says, not necessarily. We're going to see that. But first, we're talking about the tithe. Now, what do you know from this? Do you know to whom to give the tithe? No. Do you know where it should be delivered? No. All we know, this is like the code. All the tithe of the herd, all the tithe of the land shall be holy. Now, this includes everything the land produces. It's your crops, your grain, your wine, your oil, the flocks, your herd. That much we know. It's also your fruits and vegetables. But a couple of things I know Fred and I have talked about. We've talked about copper. We talk about fish. Let's turn something. Let's look at the book of Deuteronomy for just a minute here. And we're going to take a look at a particular section here, which is going to be Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 9. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 9. And here we have, talking about the land, that it's a beautiful land that God's going to give the people of Israel, land of wheat, barley in verse 8, vines, fig trees, pomegranates. And in verse 9, a land in which you shall eat bread without scarceness, you shall not lack anything in it. It is a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you may dig copper. The Bible doesn't say how to tithe on copper. It doesn't talk about fish. I mean, how could you measure the copper? How could you measure iron? Now, maybe King Solomon in his palace and the walled city of Jerusalem could mine iron and put it on the battlements. But how's he going to tithe on the iron? How's he going to tithe on the copper? Is he going to do it by the weight? Is he going to do it by the foot? Bible doesn't tell us. Well, obviously, if you have a mining consortium, because the king is going to do it all himself. If he's doing this, he's going to have a group doing it for him. Now, if they go and do it and then sell the copper or sell the brass, sell the iron, we have profit. That you can tithe on. But how many people would be doing this? You wouldn't. I wouldn't. You have your plot of land. You've got your grains. You've got your trees, your wine, your oil. How many of you would have copper? How many of you would be rich enough to go do this? So the Bible doesn't tell us much about it. But the principle is, if you could mine it and have a profit, then you could tithe because you'd have the money. But that's all it says. Because even as the Encyclopedia Judaica says, this isn't all that was tithed upon, but it was the basics. So God's interested in the basics. How about fish? Do you know that in the Talmud there is not one word about anybody ever tithing on fish? For a reason. We know that God says fins and scales, so God knew we were going to eat fish. But why? Who grew the fish? Who planted the fish? Nobody. Okay, if you were a fisherman, a commercial fisherman, such as Zebedee, you know, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, on the Sea of Galilee, if you're on the Mediterranean coast, different story. But come on, how many of us on our farms, our ranches, how many of us would be commercial fishermen? And besides that, I'm going to go fishing. I got 20 fish. Now, what do I do with two of them? Where am I going to go? How long is it going to take me, 2 days to get to the nearest Levite in the hot sun? What's my fish going to smell like? It isn't practical. So it isn't that God says, I don't want you to tithe. It's just, you didn't grow the fish. Who owned the Sea of Galilee? So you see, it's silent on it. Now, the sons of Zebedee, on the other hand, if they were catching fish, and they were selling the fish, and they got shekels of silver or copper or gold, whatever it is, yes, you could tithe on it. But not the fish itself. So you see, God's practical. That's all I'm trying to say. God is practical. So we know it's the grain, we know it's the wine and the oil. So that's the first thing. But yet, we're now going to see some exceptions. We think, well, you know, you just took 10%, that was it. No. Let us take a look. We're going to start with the first fruits. Exodus 23 and verse 19. And the same thing is in Exodus 34, verse 26. The wording is exactly the same, so we don't need to look at both. Not necessary. So let's get over to the book of Exodus, chapter 23, and we're going to look at verse 19. And what do we find? The first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. All right, you can go to, if you want to, just write it down. Chapter 34, verse 26, the wording is exactly the same. There is no difference. Now, what are the first fruits? The first fruits in general would be a section of your field. And you would go, as the crop is getting ready to be harvested, not quite yet, you're not ready for the big harvest, and you're gonna map out a small section of it, and you're going to bring this to the priest. We'll find out. How big? Well, we don't know how big. But I'll tell you, it wasn't only one ear of corn. I'll guarantee you that. It was, you could wrap your arms around it. It was the first fruit. Generally, it was understood to be something like maybe a 50th, a 60th, a 70th of the crop. This is before the tithe. So you went and you got the first fruits. And God is saying the first fruits belong to the Lord. And when we get to other places, we'll see where they deposited those first fruits. But we find that the first fruits are an exception. Now, they are given to the priests. So let's go to Numbers 18. And we will nail this section down before we get to the other exceptions of tithing. Numbers chapter 18. And in this case, we're going to go Numbers 18. And we're going to start with verse 8. Numbers 18. And verse 8. And the Lord spoke to Aaron. Now you'll notice God is bypassing Moses. God's not talking to Moses here. Because Moses was not the high priest. As great as Moses was, and he was great, he was the leader, he could not go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. That was reserved for Aaron. So this is a priestly function as such. Behold, I have also given you the charge of my heave offerings, the holy things. I have given them to you by reason of the anointing in your sons. Verse 9, they shall be yours of the most holy things. Dropping down to verse 11, and this is yours, the heave offerings, their gift, the wave offerings. I have given them to your sons. Verse 12, the best of the oil and the best of the wine and of the wheat, the first fruits of them which they shall offer to the Lord. So these went to the priest. Now, they didn't necessarily go to the priest in Jerusalem or in Shiloh. We're going to find, we may not get to it fully today, that there were 48 Levitical cities saturated throughout the land of Israel. Remember, Levi had no inheritance in the land. All the other tribes had a section of land which was theirs, but not Levi. They were scattered throughout Israel, 48 cities. 13 of them belonged to the priests, and 6 of them were cities of refuge. And we're going to zero in on those 6 cities of refuge in the criminal justice system, and I'll just whet your appetite in case I don't get to it today. We're going to see that the concept of those cities and the blood avenger and what that means, and that is going to explain to us why God is going to do what he is going to do as described in the book of Revelation, how he is going to tear this earth apart, how he is going to annihilate the beast system because of those Hebrew words and his functioning in his office, his title. And you'll never get it in the English. For 2 decades, I read over that, never saw it, until one day I was challenged to read it in the Hebrew. And there it is. It just jumps out at you. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Well, anyway, that was the first fruits. And we're not quite through with the first fruits. Turn to Deuteronomy 18, 1-5. I don't want to get us all bogged down, but I think this is a good scripture to read. Deuteronomy chapter 18. And you will see essentially the same thing. The priests, the Levites, the tribe of Levi, shall have no part or inheritance with Israel. That's what we just talked about. They shall have no inheritance. And this shall be the priests' due from the people. Once again, sacrifices of oxen, sheep, give to the priest the shoulder, the 2 cheeks, and the maw. Give to him, verse 4, the first fruit of your grain, your wine, and so forth. So clearly the first fruits went to the priest. Now let's look at the tithe. Let's look at specific exception to the tithe. Because we're told that you're supposed to give, we're all supposed to give 10% of what the land produced, right? Not so fast. Not so fast. Okay, Leviticus 19. I mentioned to you that the book of Leviticus was a book of offerings and ceremonial uncleanness. A lot of it is dull, dry reading, important reading. But the 19th chapter is one of those that are gems in terms of understanding the statutes. Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 9. And when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of the field. You shall not gather the gleaning of your harvest. Those are 2 separate things. You shall not glean your vineyards. You shall not gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God. So here we are. I'm farming. I've got my land. I don't know if it's the biggest, but I've got my square area. And God says, Mike, you see those corners? Don't you harvest those corners. You round them. But Lord, if I don't, how am I going to give you the tenth? God says, I'm not interested in that tenth exception. God's a God of social justice. He says there are poor people. Now, in another section, he says there shall be no poor among you. Well, here again, are we looking at the code? We're looking at the application. See, there's not supposed to be any poor. But because of sin, because of mistakes, because of poor judgment, whatever might be, some people, even today financially, some people get in deep doo-doo. You read $30,000, $40,000 in credit card debt, mind-boggling. Well, not God's fault, but nevertheless, God said, leave it to them. So you see, they didn't tithe on 100% of what they produced. Here's an exception. There's another exception. Gleaning the vineyard, gleaning the harvest. What was that all about? Well, when it would come my time to harvest my crop, I couldn't get all of it. Parts of it would fall down. In my vineyard, you know, part of the grapes would fall to the ground. Maybe if I had pears, peaches, oranges, whatever I had, they might fall to the ground. God says, leave them. But Lord, I can't give you ten. Do as I say. That's for the poor. God put the poor, in a sense, ahead of himself. Tells you something about the mind of God. He's very concerned about people. So he's reserving that for others. So therefore, they didn't tithe 100% of their gross. Because this is part of God's system. We didn't have all the Social Security, didn't have all the taxes, didn't have all the welfare programs. This is how God set it up. This is what he did. And the greatest example we have of that is Ruth. Remember Ruth? The Moabitess? The story of how Naomi and her husband... Well, let's look at it. Let's look at it a little bit. We'll read just a small portion here of the book of Ruth, which, if you're looking for it, is right after the Song of Solomon, right after Job. And that's going to be, we're starting out at page 826 in your faithful version, if that helps you. This is where Naomi and her husband go to Moab because there's famine in the land. The two sons go with them. They marry. Husband dies. The sons die. Tragic story. Naomi hears that the famine's over. She's going to go back to Israel. And her two daughters-in-law, they want to go with her. And you can read the entire first chapter. I don't want to get bogged down into it. But they say, we want to go with you. Naomi says, no, don't. I don't have any more sons for you. Don't. Go back to your own people. And Orpah does. But Ruth is something else. And I moved. So therefore, I have to read this to you. I'm very moved, always have been, by Ruth. Verse 14 of chapter 1. They lifted up their voice and wept again. Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. She said, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Interesting, to her gods. Return back with your sister-in-law. And Ruth said, do not beg me to leave you, to return from following after you. For where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more, if anything but death parts you and me. Now you talk about steadfast loyalty. You talk about conversion. You talk about wholehearted steadfast loyalty. Nothing is like it. Now, Fred explained to me something that I didn't quite get for many years. We read about it yesterday. Many are called, but few are chosen. I could never fully get that. If God's calling many, why is he only choosing a few? Because the calling is not sometimes what we think is a calling. If you hear the word of God, if you read the truth, if you hear the truth, it's a general calling. And the problem is only a few respond. So if only a few respond, God can call only the few who respond. This was one of those who responded. In fact, notice in verse 11 of chapter 2, just over the next page, she's in the field of Boaz when she came back with Naomi. Boaz answered and said to her, it has been fully shown to me all that you have done to your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. You've left your father and your mother. What did Jesus say? He who is not willing to leave father and mother, sister and brother, you know, even leave your own life. Read that in terms of Ruth. You've left your father and your mother and the land of your birth. You've left everything and have come to a people whom you did not know before now. May the Lord repay your work. And may a full reward be given you from the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Did God choose her? She became the ancestor of David and the ancestor of the Christ himself. Now, if that isn't being chosen, I don't know what is. So, what can you say? And if you read the whole chapter, you'll read how the gleanings, how there were the people doing the harvesting, and they had burlap sacks or whatever they had to put in the grain. Well, some of it fell to the ground. What did God say? Leave it. So not only am I not harvesting the corners of my field, even when I am harvesting, I can't even pick up what falls to the ground there. God says, leave it to the poor. So here were two exceptions on tithing. Now, our scope today is to understand this system as it worked in Israel, not to figure out what it's going to be like in the world tomorrow, not to figure how we should do it today, because we could really run wild. So we're going to take a look furthermore at that system. All right. Now let's go back to Leviticus 27, because this is going to tell us something about those animals that God said were holy to him. Leviticus 27, and there, starting again in verse 30, but we're going to drop down. We're not going to talk about verse 30 so much. We're going to talk about the tithe of the herd and of the flock, all that passes under the rod. Well, the way they did that was to corral their animals. And I brought this out down there in Arcadia. Each rancher, each farmer would have his animals in a corral. And they did this three times during the year, before each holy day. And there'd be set times, and they'd start the animals going through a chute. And as I kiddingly talk about my father-in-law and my mother-in-law, they were so devoted fans of Lawrence Welk. Okay, well, Lawrence Welk provided some good entertainment for people. But as I said, and the owner would be with his rod, and he'd be counting them. You know, a one, not two, a three. Okay, and when the tenth one came, you marked it with a red dye. Now, the interesting thing is, what about going to the feast? There was no second tithe on animals. It was different. We're going to see that. We today have a monetary system. So therefore, I make $50,000 a year, $10,000 a year, $100,000 a year, however much God's blessed me, and I can figure out 10% and so forth. But that's not how it was done in ancient Israel. They didn't take a second 10% of their animals. No, they didn't. It was the firstlings of the flock. We'll see that a little later. But what I want to emphasize is something that I didn't bring out down there. He shall not, verse 33, he shall not search whether it's good or bad, neither shall he change it. And if he changes it at all, then both of them shall be holy. God said, I don't care if it's the runt. I don't care if there's a blemish on it. Don't change that animal. That's mine. But he didn't say it with the firstborn. That is most interesting. And that we need to come and take a look at, because I want to compare that with the firstborn. And we're going to start in Exodus 13. Keep in mind about the tithe of the animal and look at the difference that God has. And he says, Exodus chapter 13 and verses 11 to 15. And it shall be when the Lord brings you to the land of Canaan as he swore to you, you shall set apart to the Lord all that opens the womb. Every firstborn that comes of any animal which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. Now that is, we would call that reading the regulation. Look up at verse 2, just 10 verses up or so. Sanctify all the firstborn to me. Whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, of man, of beast, it is mine. Well, that's not complete. That's not true in a way. It is true, but that's the code. Down below, it says the males. So what do we know? Not every firstborn that came out of the womb was sacrificed to God. The males were. So when we get to the firstling of the flocks that you're going to bring to the feast, guess which ones you brought? The females. But you have to You have to remember, this is a book of law, and it's written as a code book. And if you don't realize that, and for years I didn't realize that, and I'm scratching my head, well, what is this? Until it dawned on me one day, of course, you idiot. That's me. I'm the idiot. Okay. It's written as a law book. So why don't you read it as a law book? And once I did that, it made sense. Okay. Now let's look at Deuteronomy 15. And this is what is so interesting. Deuteronomy chapter 15. Once again, we're talking about the firstborn. Deuteronomy chapter 15, 15 and verse 19. As soon as I get my fingers in operation here. Here we are. All the firstborn males that come from your herd and from your flock, you shall set apart to the Lord your God. You shall do no work with the firstborn of your bull, nor shear the firstborn of your sheep. You shall eat before the Lord your God year by year in the place which the Lord shall choose, you and your household. This is very interesting because what does this mean? That I am going to eat the firstborn male? Well, the rabbis will tell you that when you see like that, you shall eat before the Lord your God year by year. They say, I'm not so sure they're right, but they will tell you, well, this means the people who are legally entitled to do it, which would be the priests. But the context doesn't tell me that. So, I don't know. It could also mean, and we don't know how this was done either, when you offered up the firstborn, did it all go to the priest? We're not told. Or did some of it go back to you that you could eat? Possibility. But regardless of how we look at that, it doesn't specifically say you shall eat it. It's just a statement. You shall eat before the Lord your God year by year. So we're kind of at a loss here as to exactly how to understand that. But the key is verse 21. If there's a blemish in it, lame or blindness, or any ill blemish, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. Didn't we read where every male animal firstborn is holy, is mine? And here God saying, hold it. If there's a blemish in it, don't bring it. I don't want it. I will not accept it. Why? And there is a reason. You shall eat it inside your gates, verse 22. The one who is unclean, this is ceremonial now. This is not unclean person per se, but the one who is ceremonially unclean. And the one who is clean shall eat it alike as the gazelle and as the deer. All right. Why does God say that? Well, excuse me. Okay, got to ring Fred's cowbell here. Because I can't prove this to you in black and white. But I will tell you this, my opinion, for what it's worth. Who or what is the ultimate firstborn sacrifice? Did not John the Baptist say the first chapter of John, behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. When God caused this to be written, he knew, 1,500 years later, a firstborn son would be born to him who would be perfect. Turn over to 2 Corinthians. Do we get that? 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And we will have it there. 2 Corinthians 5. And if I do have this correct, should be verse 2 Corinthians 5. Let me get here. Let me make sure I've got my, where I have it here. I had written it down to be absolute. Yes, I'm sorry. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21. For he made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. A perfect sacrifice spiritually. Then if you go over to Psalm 34, verse 20, you'll find the phrase, not a bone of his shall be broken. In other words, this sacrifice is to be perfect physically, is to be perfect spiritually. And the type had also to be perfect. It was a type of the great firstborn sacrifice to come down the road. And that, in As I said, I rang the cowbell. I can't prove it to you, but I believe that. Now, Fred may want to comment more on that later, but this firstborn was a type of the firstborn son of God himself. So that is the difference between the animal of the tithe and the firstborn. Both holy, but God said it's an exception. So if you read the Bible and you see a statement and then something contradicts it, it's not a contradiction. It's just a different aspect of God's law. So that'll tell us there. Now, my time is slowly running out, so I want to cover, as I said, believe me, we could spend hours on this. You have no idea how much time we could spend on this and not exhaust the subject. I'll take that back. I'm going to whet your appetite. We're going to talk about God's criminal justice system for the next 5, maybe 10 minutes. That's all. And I'll be able to conclude with my best Southern phraseology. Y'all come back. See? So y'all come back tomorrow and you'll get the full understanding of it. But we're going to look at Numbers 35. Numbers chapter 35, because this is beginning God's criminal justice system with the Levitical cities. Because I remembered, where do you give your tithes to the priests? Well, where were the priests located? Where were the Levites located? They were located throughout Israel. So you could go to a Levite near you. See? You don't have to go down to Jerusalem. At 48 cities to choose from. Now, of course, if it were close to the time of a festival and you wanted to bring it to Jerusalem or Charlotte, well, of course you could. But you didn't have to. All right? It wasn't required. So here we are. And so the Lord spoke to Moses on the plains of Moab besides Jordan, verse 1. Command the children of Israel that they give to the Levites cities to live in. And the next 4 or 5 verses, we come to, it describes the cities. And verse 6, and among the cities which you shall give to the Levites, there shall be 6 cities for refuge, which you shall appoint for the manslayer, so that he may flee. And you shall add 42 cities to them. All the cities which shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities. So these cities were scattered throughout Israel. And we're going to find out, we won't get into that today, don't have time, but tomorrow we will wrap up this section. 3 were on east of the Jordan, 3 were west of the Jordan. And why would you go there? Well, you went there in case of a homicide that was not premeditated murder. All right? And we're going to find that the blood avenger is very significant, and blood is very significant. And I never realized this until I saw it in the Hebrew and realized how important blood is to God throughout. Not just the life of the flesh is in the blood, but when you think about that and you realize what spilling the blood means to God, whoa, that's big time sin. So all the cities which shall, verse 13, and the cities which you shall choose shall be the 6 cities of refuge. You shall give 3 cities on this side of the Jordan, 3 cities in the land of Canaan to be cities of refuge. And you can go on down, and here we are. These 6 cities shall be a refuge for the children of Israel, and for the stranger, and for anyone who stays among them, so that anyone who kills any person through error may flee there. And if he strikes him with an instrument of iron so that he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. If he strikes him by throwing a stone with which he may die, and if he dies, he's a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he strikes him with a hand weapon, a wood, with which he may die, he's a murderer. And 19, the revenger of blood himself shall kill the murderer when he meets him. He shall kill him. No police force. There was no police force. If a crime were committed and your child was killed, or your brother or your sister, then you, whether you're the uncle, the father, the brother, the son, you were obligated to go after this man and kill him. Now, on the other hand, the perpetrator could flee to a city of refuge. We just don't have to go over it all today, but we will tomorrow. And make his case before the elders of that city, which were primarily Levites and priests, and explain the situation. And they could bring him in. And there would be a tribunal held. Meantime, trust me, the blood avenger is hot on the trail. And he is going to come. And he is going to make his case. And there will be a tribunal, and they will decide whether he's a murderer or whether it was by accident. You know, not premeditated, manslaughter, involuntary manslaughter, whatever legal term you want to use. And if it was determined that it was involuntary manslaughter, hold it, blood avenger, back you go to your city. And that individual who committed the unfortunate deed had to stay in that city until the death of the high priest. So we had a sentence of imprisonment with possibility of parole. Now, of course, if the high priest was long, long, long lived, it may be a life imprisonment, okay? On the other hand, if the high priest did live that long, you might only be there for 5 or 10 years. It just depended on the system. The reason for this is the mind of God. And I thought to myself, well, come on. If you committed a crime that way, you're so negligent, you mean you could be free to move around in the city? Yes. What was God's point of view? What was God trying to, what was his objective? He didn't want revenge. He didn't want someone to be killed unnecessarily. He knew he was dealing with hot-blooded human beings, filled with human nature, vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. And he tried his best, using an imperfect people, to try to avoid that. Now, on the other hand, something very interesting, which we'll get to, how did you know he would be worthy of being put to death? In today's system, criminal justice system, so many people have been found to have been innocent. Why? They didn't follow God's instructions. What did God say at the mouth of two or more witnesses? If you didn't have two or more witnesses, sorry, no death penalty, period. Well, you mean if I saw him kill somebody, I actually saw him do it. Sorry, God says, no death penalty. Because number one, God knows he's dealing with defective human beings, flawed human beings. And it could be a misguided witness. Maybe he thought he saw what he saw. Maybe he didn't really see what he saw, but he thought he saw it. So God is saying, I'm not going to let the lamb just flow with blood. In that case, we'll overlook it. Because God's besides, you still got to be in prison in the city anyway. So God said in the mouth of two witnesses, you had to have two. Now maybe today with DNA, maybe with camcorders, we could actually see it done and there could be 100 witnesses that way maybe. But that's today, okay? We're not talking about today. We're talking about the system God set up back then. But this blood avenger, and we will soon wrap this up, we're going to see the word blood avenger, and we're going to see the word redeemer. And we're going to see the connection between those two words and what they mean. And by using those words, God has a title, which is blood avenger. And in essence, God is duty-bound to avenge the blood of his people, his children. As the blood avenger did that, we're going to see what those Hebrew words mean and how God, what he does to the beast power, what he does to the satanic system will be to avenge the blood of his people from righteous Abel clear on down. And he's doing it as if he's obligated to do it, we'll see from the Hebrew. Now, if I go much longer, I will definitely run out of time. So at this point, again, I will say in my best southern drawl, tomorrow, y'all come back, and we'll complete this and show you exactly from scriptures in Revelation and elsewhere the connection of blood and God being the blood avenger. He does it legally, not with wanton disregard. His emotions don't run away with him. He does it specifically, and we'll see that tomorrow.